On the night of January 15, 1989, in a quiet Westchester suburb, a single gunshot shattered the calm. 40-year-old Betty Jean Solomon was found in her own home, pistol-whipped and shot 9 times in the back. The scene screamed of passion and betrayal. The prime suspect? A 25-year-old elementary school teacher named Carolyn Warmus, whose affair with Betty Jean's husband would come to echo the terror of Fatal Attraction. From her affluent Detroit upbringing and elite education to her intoxicating romance with married teacher Paul Solomon, Warmus's life seemed pulled from a Hollywood script. But in real life, nuance is cruel and clear answers are rare. A hung jury, a mysterious glove, allegations of stalking, and decades of claimed innocence. So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform and leave us a comment. Because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. Chapter 1. Two Lives, One Secret. Carolyn Warmus was born into wealth and privilege in suburban Michigan. Her father, a prominent insurance executive, gave her a life of comfort, private schools, elite universities, and every opportunity to succeed. Intelligent, attractive, and well-educated, she had the polished exterior of a young woman destined for success. But beneath the surface, something was fractured. By 1987, Carolyn had landed a job as a fifth-grade teacher at Greenville Elementary School in Scarsdale, New York. She was 23 years old, fresh out of graduate school, and starting a new chapter of her life. That's where she met Paul Solomon, a charismatic older colleague who was everything Carolyn wasn't, married, grounded, and experienced. Paul was 40, a well-liked teacher with a teenage daughter and a wife named Betty Jean Solomon. Despite his family life, Paul was drawn to Carolyn's youthful energy and flattery. Their relationship, once professional, soon turned romantic. For Carolyn, it was intoxicating. Paul seemed to offer the one thing she craved, validation. He confided in her about his unhappy marriage, hinted at a future together, and encouraged her affection. At first, it was an affair like many others. Secret lunches, stolen weekends, whispered phone calls. But Carolyn didn't want to be the possession of a weapon. The courtroom fell silent. Carolyn didn't cry. She didn't flinch. She simply stared forward, lips pressed, as the reality sank in. She would serve 25 years to life. Her legal team vowed to appeal. Outside, the media had a field day. Teacher turned killer. Fatal obsession. The Scarsdale murderess. Paul Solomon, for his part, was never charged with any crime. He left the courthouse quietly and refused further interviews. Some believed he had manipulated 2 women and walked away untouched. Others believed he was simply a man who had made a terrible mistake. Cheating on his wife, then losing her in the most horrific way imaginable. But for Carolyn Warmus, the path forward was fixed. She was sent to Bedford Hills Correctional Facility, a maximum security women's prison in upstate New York. There, she would remain for decades, never ceasing to declare her innocence. She insisted she had been framed. She insisted Paul had lied. And she insisted that one day, the truth would come out. Chapter 5. Prison, parole, and the oxygen special. The steel gates of Bedford Hills Correctional Facility closed behind Carolyn Warmus in 1992, sealing off the life she once knew. The private schools, the upper-middle-class suburban dream, the long walks through Scarsdale. It was all gone. In its place, a concrete cell, steel bunk, and an inmate number that would define her for the next 27 years. She was 30 years old. From the beginning, Carolyn maintained her innocence. She appealed her conviction almost immediately, citing procedural errors, questionable forensics, and the glove's unexplained chain of custody. But the courts rejected every motion. With each denial, the headlines faded and the public moved on. But Carolyn didn't. Inside prison walls, she built a new kind of life, one structured around routine and quiet determination. She worked in the prison library. She tutored other inmates. She earned a master's degree in English literature behind bars. And in private, she studied her own case, page by page, record by record, building what she believed would one day be the foundation for her release. For years, Carolyn rarely spoke to the media. When she did, she repeated the same claim. "I didn't kill Betty Jean Solomon." But the public wasn't ready to hear it. To many, Carolyn was the embodiment of the jealous mistress trope, a woman who saw her lover's wife as an obstacle, not a person. That narrative, once cemented by the trial, remained largely unchallenged for more than two decades. Then, everything changed. In 2017, the true crime boom reignited public interest in her case. Podcasts, documentaries, and streaming platforms sought to re-examine old convictions. The Carolyn Warmus story, twisted, glamorous, and full of unanswered questions, was ripe for a second look. That's when the Oxygen Network announced it was producing The Fatal Attraction Murder, a two-part television special investigating the Warmus case in depth. The producers promised something different, not just a rehash of courtroom drama, but new forensic reviews, unheard voices, and modern analysis using technologies that didn't exist in 1992. The series aired in 2022 and sent shockwaves through the true crime community. Viewers were stunned to learn that some key pieces of evidence had never been DNA tested, including the glove. Even more disturbing was the discovery that hair samples and fingerprints collected from the crime scene had never been conclusively matched to Carolyn or ruled out as belonging to someone else. Carolyn's legal team used the show's momentum to file new motions. They requested DNA testing on the glove, bullets, and items found near the victim's body. Their argument was simple. Science had evolved, as in so should justice. The court agreed. In 2021, a judge authorized limited DNA testing of physical evidence from the case. The results, while inconclusive, did not match Carolyn Warmus. That didn't prove her innocence. But it raised questions that hadn't been fully considered during either trial. More than two decades after her conviction, Carolyn's parole board began to look at her case with new eyes. By then, she had been denied parole three times, in 2017, 2018, and again in 2019. Each time, the board cited a lack of remorse. Carolyn, still asserting her innocence, refused to admit guilt. And in the parole system, remorse often equals progress. Without it, inmates remain stuck. But in 2021, the tone shifted. This time, Carolyn came prepared with more than just claims of innocence. She had education, credentials, work records, testimonials from prison staff, and new forensic findings. She also had public support, not from the Solomon family, but from legal reform advocates and viewers who now saw her story through a different lens. On June 17, 2021, Carolyn Warmus was granted parole. After 27 years in prison, she walked out of Bedford Hills as a free woman, gray-haired, aged by time, but composed. The same sharp intelligence that once charmed a married man in a school hallway now stared calmly into a dozen news cameras. "I didn't do this," she said, "and I will keep proving it." She immediately announced plans to pursue full exoneration, including filing for a conviction review and expanded forensic testing. Her team began examining whether the original prosecutors had overlooked alternative suspects, especially given the absence of hard evidence tying her directly to the murder weapon or scene. Not everyone supported her release. Members of Bettie Jean Solomon's family were devastated. Her daughter, now an adult, said the pain hadn't lessened and that she still believed Carolyn was responsible. Paul Solomon declined to comment. For him, the years had been turbulent. He remarried, moved out of state, and avoided the media. But questions lingered. Why had he stored the glove? Why did he rekindle the affair with Carolyn after the murder? Why had he remained, in the eyes of some, suspicious but untouched? The Oxygen Special made no direct accusations, but it didn't have to. It planted seeds of doubt that had taken root in the minds of many viewers. And Carolyn, for the first time in decades, wasn't the only one under scrutiny. In interviews following her release, she said she had learned to survive prison by compartmentalizing, that she'd never lost hope, that she still had nightmares about that January night. Not because she committed a crime, but because she lost her freedom to a story that didn't match the facts. Her mission now is clear. Overturn her conviction, clear her name, and tell her side without a judge or prosecutor cutting her off. But the legal system moves slowly. Full exoneration is rare, and even successful DNA appeals often take years to finalize. In the meantime, Carolyn remains on parole. She must check in regularly, follow restrictions, and cannot leave the state without approval. Still, she is free. And as the world debates whether justice was served or stolen, she prepares for her next chapter. Chapter 6. Innocent or obsessed? The question still haunts everyone who's followed the Carolyn Warmus case for over 3 decades. Was she truly innocent? Or just the embodiment of obsession gone too far? In the years since her release from prison in 2021, Carolyn Warmus has fought not just for her freedom, but for the truth as she sees it. Her case has come to symbolize something much larger than a single murder. The fault lines in the American justice system, the limits of forensic science in the 1980s, and the cultural hunger to simplify complex women into villains. Her supporters call her a scapegoat. They point to the lack of direct evidence. No eyewitnesses, no murder weapon, no DNA, no confession. They note the glove, the central piece of the prosecution's case, had an uncertain chain of custody and was found in Paul Solomon's possession. And they question why Paul, the person with the most to gain from his wife's death, was never treated as a serious suspect. At the time of the murder, Paul's life was unraveling. His marriage was strained, his affair with Carolyn was falling apart, and his professional reputation was under pressure. And then, almost out of nowhere, his wife was dead, shot in their home, execution style. He was the first to find her. He gave inconsistent accounts of his whereabouts. And later, he stored the alleged murder glove in a private bank vault. Despite all of that, he walked free. That contradiction sits at the heart of Carolyn's current campaign for justice. "It's not just about me," she said in interviews. "It's about the system. It's about women who don't fit into neat boxes. It's about what happens when you become the easy target." But there are still many who believe she was guilty, and that the jury got it right the second time. Former detectives on the case insist that Carolyn's behavior after the murder was telling. Her attempts to reconnect with Paul, her refusal to take no for an answer, her erratic visits and obsessive phone calls, these weren't the actions of someone in mourning. They were the behaviors of someone who couldn't let go. And then there was the gun. Records showed that she purchased a .25 caliber Beretta, matching the caliber of bullets used in the crime, under a false name shortly before the murder. Though the weapon was never recovered, prosecutors argued that its disappearance pointed to deliberate cover-up. Carolyn claimed the gun was stolen and denied ever using it. But questions about the investigation continue to surface. One of the biggest criticisms surrounds the forensic limitations of the original trial. At the time, DNA analysis was in its infancy. Much of the physical evidence collected, hairs, fibers, blood traces, were examined using now outdated techniques. Today's DNA technology could potentially identify new sources of material at the crime scene or rule out previously assumed connections. In 2021, after new testing was approved, preliminary results indicated that some of the DNA present at the scene did not match Carolyn Warmus. These results were not enough to exonerate her, but they did weaken the case that had kept her behind bars for nearly three decades. Carolyn's legal team is now pushing for a full conviction integrity review, a process in which a special division of the district attorney's office reinvestigates a closed case to determine whether a wrongful conviction occurred. These reviews are rare, and success is even rarer, but not impossible. Her team has also pointed to changing attitudes around women in the legal system. They argue that Carolyn was portrayed not as a person, but as a caricature. The dangerous seductress, the unhinged mistress, the woman scorned. That the prosecution's case leaned heavily on her sexuality, her appearance, her boldness. Traits that, in a man, might have been seen as confidence rather than threat. For Carolyn, the fight isn't only legal, it's personal. She's written essays, appeared on documentaries, and continues to share her version of events. She now lives quietly under parole restrictions, but remains actively engaged in her case. And she's not alone. In recent years, high-profile figures in the criminal justice reform world have taken interest in her story. Civil rights attorneys, legal podcast hosts, and forensic experts have started to raise questions about the integrity of her trial. A few have even compared her to other, controversial cases. Women convicted amid media frenzy, whose convictions were later overturned or deeply scrutinized. But opposition remains strong. The Solomon family still firmly believes in her guilt. Betty Jean's daughter has spoken publicly, saying that the relitigation of the case reopens deep wounds. To them, Carolyn isn't a misunderstood woman. She's a murderer who destroyed a family. And that is the central tension of this story. Justice versus perception, evidence versus emotion, guilt versus doubt. No matter how many interviews Carolyn gives, or how many legal motions are filed, one truth remains. Betty Jean Solomon was brutally murdered in her home, and no one has ever been definitively proven guilty through physical evidence. Carolyn Warmus may be out of prison, but she's not free. Not yet. Until a court officially overturns her conviction or clears her name, she remains a convicted killer, bound by the conditions of parole and public opinion. And perhaps that's what haunts this case the most. Not what we know, but what we may never know. Chapter 7. The Final Verdict. 35 years have passed since the night Betty Jean Solomon was murdered in her quiet Westchester home. The headlines have faded. The courthouse is quiet. But the echoes of that night still reverberate through the lives of everyone it touched. Carolyn Warmus now lives a life in the shadows of notoriety. She was released from Bedford Hills Correctional Facility in 2021 after serving 27 years for second-degree murder and weapons possession. Technically, she is free. She walks through society, holds a phone again, sees the skyline without bars or barbed wire. But freedom doesn't erase conviction. She remains a felon on parole. Her name still triggers debate. Some still whisper killer when they pass her photo in a news article or stumble across one of the countless documentaries about her case. Others see something different. An emblem of injustice. A woman convicted in an era when courtroom theatrics and public spectacle often drowned out reason. In the years since her release, Carolyn has turned her focus to advocacy. She supports criminal justice reform and continues to push for a full review of her conviction. She's filed legal motions requesting that more items from the original investigation, hair, fingernail scrapings, fiber samples, be subjected to modern DNA testing. Her attorneys are calling for a conviction integrity unit to formally reopen her case. Their argument is simple. Evidence that could confirm her guilt or innocence exists, and today's technology could finally reveal the truth. But the district attorney's office has yet to grant the full review. Meanwhile, the other central figure in this saga, Paul Solomon, has all but vanished from public life. After testifying at both trials, Paul largely withdrew from media attention. He eventually remarried and moved out of New York. Despite being a pivotal figure in the events surrounding Betty Jean's death, he was never charged with any crime. Many still question his role. Not necessarily in the murder itself, but in the events surrounding it. Why did he store the glove? Why rekindle the relationship with Carolyn after the murder? Why not come forward with clearer answers? Those questions may never be answered. For the Solomon family, the past cannot be rewritten. Betty Jean was a quiet, hardworking woman, a mother, a wife. Her life ended violently, and no amount of legal back and forth will bring her back. Her daughter, Kristen, who was a teenager when her mother was killed, has expressed frustration with how the media continues to focus on Carolyn rather than on the victim. In her eyes, Carolyn's release brought no closure, only fresh pain. The media, meanwhile, continues to repackage the case in different formats. Docuseries, podcasts, dramatizations. Each time, a new wave of speculation follows. Viewers and listeners come away with new theories, opinions, doubts. But the facts remain the same. There was no eyewitness. No murder weapon was ever recovered. The glove, arguably the strongest piece of evidence, was found in a safe deposit box owned by the victim's husband. The DNA results from recent testing are inconclusive but intriguing, and the one woman convicted has never confessed. In today's post in Me Too, post wrongful conviction reform era, public opinion is shifting. More people now recognize the ways bias can influence trials, especially when gender, class, and media are involved. Carolyn Warmus, once vilified, is now seen by some as a product of her time, woman punished as much for her emotions and sexuality as for any alleged crime. But that's not the final word. The legal system moves slowly, but it does move. If new DNA tests reveal alternate suspects or eliminate Carolyn as a contributor to key evidence, her team could file for a vacatur, a legal mechanism to set aside her conviction. That would be the first step toward exoneration. And yet, even that may not be enough, because this case has transcended the courtroom. It lives in public consciousness, in true crime forums, university case studies, media think pieces. It's taught in law classes and debated in documentaries. And perhaps the reason it continues to resonate is because it never truly offered closure. It's not just about guilt or innocence. It's about obsession, perception, power, gender, and the price of desire. the final verdict, isn't carved into stone. It lives in every retelling of the story, every skeptical glance at a news headline, every young woman labeled too emotional or too dangerous simply for wanting love. So where does that leave us? Carolyn Warmus walks free. But the question lingers. Was she a calculating killer? Or the casualty of a justice system that wanted answers, any answers, too badly? Other woman. She wanted more. She believed Paul would eventually leave his wife. She waited, hoping, obsessing. And when it became clear that Paul had no intention of ending his marriage, something in Carolyn shifted. There were warning signs. Before moving to New York, she had allegedly exhibited obsessive behavior with a man she had once dated. She'd reportedly sent letters, made repeated phone calls, and shown up uninvited. Friends said she couldn't handle rejection. She fixated on unavailable men and didn't take no for an answer. Still, no one could have imagined what would happen next. By late 1988, Paul began pulling away. The affair cooled. Carolyn became erratic, calling constantly, following him to events, even attempting to confront women she believed he was dating. She once traveled to Puerto Rico and impersonated law enforcement officers in an effort to find him. She was unraveling, but no one acted. In January 1989, something dark took root. According to investigators, Carolyn began asking colleagues strange questions about firearms. Soon after, she purchased a 25-caliber Beretta handgun, a silencer, and ammunition. She registered for shooting lessons, all while continuing to pressure Paul, emotionally and physically, to stay in her life. And then, on the evening of January 15th, 1989, Betty Jean Solomon was found dead in the basement of her home in Greenburn, New York. She had been shot 9 times in the back and legs. Her skull had been fractured by blunt force, likely from the butt of the pistol. There were no signs of forced entry, no valuables taken. It wasn't a robbery. It was personal, savage, intentional. When Paul discovered his wife's body, he was devastated. Police responded quickly and noted his grief appeared genuine, but his alibi was weak. He claimed to have been at the gym, then at a bowling alley, but few witnesses could confirm his exact timeline. Still, investigators quickly turned their attention to someone else, Carolyn Warmus. She had motive, opportunity, and a growing pattern of obsession. In the days following the murder, she behaved strangely, calling Paul incessantly, showing up unannounced and inserting herself into the investigation. As detectives began piecing together the events leading up to Betty Jean's murder, a chilling picture emerged. A woman who believed she was entitled to a life that wasn't hers, willing to eliminate anyone standing in her way. The question now wasn't just whether Carolyn had done it. It was how far she was willing to go to make the fantasy real. Chapter 2. The Night of the Murder. It was Sunday, January 15th, 1989. In the sleepy suburb of Greenburg, New York, the winter air hung thick and still. The Solomon House, a modest two-story home tucked away on a quiet cul-de-sac, looked unremarkable from the outside. Inside, however, a storm was brewing. That evening, Betty Jean Solomon was alone. Her teenage daughter was away, and her husband, Paul, claimed to be out bowling with colleagues. What Betty Jean didn't know was that the cracks in her marriage had grown into chasms, wide enough for someone else to slip through. Shortly after 7 p.m., neighbors heard nothing unusual. No gunshots, no screams. Just the familiar stillness of a suburban Sunday. But by 11:42 p.m., everything changed. Paul Solomon returned home from his night out and immediately sensed something was wrong. The lights were on, but Betty Jean didn't answer his calls. He walked through the kitchen, then down the stairs into the basement, where he found his wife lying motionless in a pool of blood. She had been shot 9 times. 6 bullets in the back, 3 more scattered across her legs and lower body. Her face was bruised, her skull fractured. A .25-caliber weapon had been used, likely with a silencer. There were no signs of a break-in, and nothing appeared stolen. The scene was cold, brutal, and deliberate. Paul called 911 in a panic. When emergency responders arrived, they found him kneeling beside his wife, sobbing uncontrollably. He claimed to have no idea who could have done such a thing. He said he had been bowling that night, that he had only left the house briefly, and that everything had seemed normal when he left. But nothing about the scene was normal. The absence of forced entry suggested the victim knew her killer. The precision of the shooting indicated rage, but controlled rage. This wasn't a random act of violence. It was intimate. Greenberg detectives arrived quickly and began their work. They noted the tight grouping of the bullet wounds and the absence of defensive injuries. Betty Jean likely didn't see it coming. She had either been ambushed or approached by someone she did not fear. That's when the investigators' attention shifted to Paul. He was the husband, after all, the grieving spouse. But as the hours passed, details began to trouble the detectives. Paul's story about his whereabouts that night lacked clear confirmation. The bowling alley staff gave vague answers. Some recalled seeing him, others didn't. His timeline was fuzzy. But Paul wasn't just any husband. He was a man known to be having an affair with a younger woman. And that woman, Carolyn Warmus, was about to become the center of the investigation. In the early morning hours of January 16th, detectives quietly began looking into Paul's relationships. One name kept coming up. Colleagues at Greenville Elementary mentioned his close friendship with another teacher. Parents had noticed the two together after school hours. And then there were the rumors. Carolyn's jealousy, her intense behavior, and her frequent visits to Paul's classroom. Within 24 hours, police contacted Carolyn Warmus for questioning. She was calm, poised, and articulate. She denied knowing anything about Betty Jean's death. She said she had spoken to Paul that night on the phone, but hadn't seen him in person. She had spent the evening at home, she claimed, watching television. But there were holes in her story. She couldn't clearly account for the time between 6:30 p.m. and 10 p.m. Her phone records didn't match the timeline she described, and her emotional tone, detached, almost rehearsed, raised suspicions. Investigators also noticed something else. Carolyn didn't ask about Betty Jean, not once. She showed no visible concern for the victim. 2 days later, police received a tip from a private investigator hired by Paul months earlier to monitor Carolyn's behavior. The report included notes about her obsessive tendencies, showing up at his apartment uninvited, confronting women she believed were involved with him, and calling repeatedly from blocked numbers. There were reports she had followed him to the gym, to restaurants, even to the bowling alley. Carolyn, it seemed, had not taken the breakup well. The investigation ramped up. Detectives searched local gun stores and found records of Carolyn purchasing a .25-caliber pistol just days before the murder. The paperwork showed she had used a false name and address. She had also bought a box of ammunition and, according to the clerk, had asked specific questions about silencers. That detail hit hard. The medical examiner had confirmed that Betty Jean's murder had likely been committed using a silenced weapon, given the absence of loud noise reports from neighbors. Still, the case remained circumstantial. There was no murder weapon, No eyewitness, no surveillance footage, and Carolyn had no prior criminal record. The prosecution needed more. Then came a strange twist. A few weeks after the murder, Paul and Carolyn rekindled their relationship. Despite everything, despite the death of his wife and the cloud of suspicion, Paul welcomed Carolyn back into his life. They went on trips. They dined in public. They acted as if nothing had changed. To detectives, this was confirmation. Carolyn hadn't acted alone, they believed. She'd acted with confidence, perhaps even with an unspoken understanding that Paul wouldn't abandon her afterward. But the investigation stalled. It would be nearly a year before prosecutors had enough to move forward. They needed physical evidence. Something undeniable. Something that could tie Carolyn to the scene. Directly and indisputably. Then, nearly 11 months later, they found it. Or thought they did. It came in the form of a glove. Chapter 3. The Smoking Glove. 11 months had passed since Bettie Jean Solomon was murdered in her own basement. No arrests had been made. The trail had grown cold. Paul Solomon remained free, and Carolyn Warmus, though heavily scrutinized, was living her life. Teaching, dating, socializing. Publicly, she seemed untouchable. Privately, she remained under a microscope. Detectives had collected plenty of circumstantial evidence. The affair, the gun purchase, the erratic behavior. But none of it would hold in court without something physical, something irrefutable. Then, in December 1989, almost a full year after the murder, the breakthrough came. A colleague of Paul Solomon's, another teacher at Greenville Elementary, approached investigators with an unusual claim. She said Paul had asked her, shortly after the murder, to store a safe deposit box key. He never told her why. At the time, she thought it was strange, but didn't press him. Now, nearly a year later, her curiosity and suspicion had grown. Detectives located the safe deposit box at a nearby Manhattan bank. They obtained a warrant and opened it. Inside was a single item, a tan cashmere glove. That glove would change everything. It was small, elegant, and stained with what appeared to be dried blood. Forensic analysis confirmed it belonged to Carolyn Warmus. Traces of blood matched Bettie Jean Solomon's type. A ballistics test showed fibers from the glove were consistent with those found in the basement where the murder occurred. Suddenly, what had once been a circumstantial case now had teeth. Investigators believed the glove had been worn during the murder. Its placement in Paul Solomon's safe deposit box raised difficult questions. Had he helped cover up the crime? Had he been complicit? Or had Carolyn given him the glove to hide without his full understanding of what it meant? The police decided it didn't matter. Not yet. In January 1990, Carolyn Warmus was arrested and charged with second-degree murder and criminal possession of a weapon. She was calm during her arrest, denying everything. Her attorneys claimed the glove had been planted, that Paul was setting her up, that she was being punished for having an affair with a man whose wife had been murdered under mysterious circumstances. But the public saw it differently. The case exploded in the media. Dubbed the Fatal Attraction Murder, it echoed the themes of the popular film. A beautiful, emotionally unstable woman, obsessed with a married man, resorting to violence when rejected. The story was too sensational to ignore. Wealth, romance, betrayal, murder. And now, a designer glove left behind like a calling card. In March 1991, Carolyn Warmus went to trial. The prosecution laid out its case with precision. They called over 40 witnesses, police, ballistics experts, friends, co-workers. They showed Carolyn's receipt for the .25 caliber gun. They produced phone records showing repeated calls to Paul and Betty Jean in the days leading up to the murder. They highlighted Carolyn's erratic behavior, including impersonating a police officer and confronting women in Paul's life. Most damning was the glove. The prosecution argued that it was proof Carolyn had been at the crime scene, that she had worn it while firing the shots, that she had taken it off, bloodied and incriminating, and passed it to Paul for safekeeping. Why else would he hide it in a bank? But the defense fought back. They challenged the glove's chain of custody. There was no record of when it was placed in the safe deposit box, no fingerprints, no surveillance footage. They painted Paul as manipulative, a man who had maintained multiple relationships, even during the investigation into his wife's death. A man who had something to hide. Carolyn's attorneys also questioned the thoroughness of the forensic testing. They argued that the bloodstains were too faint to conclusively tie the glove to the crime, that the prosecution was building a narrative, not a case. Then came the biggest shock of the trial. Paul Solomon testified. On the stand, he admitted to the affair with Carolyn. He described her behavior after the murder as obsessive and erratic. But when asked directly whether he believed she had killed his wife, he refused to say. He deflected. He said he couldn't be sure. He expressed regret, sadness, and confusion, but never gave a definitive answer. It was a moment that fractured the prosecution's momentum. If Paul, whose wife was the victim, couldn't or wouldn't say Carolyn was guilty, what did that mean? The jury deliberated for days. In April 1991, the result came in: a hung jury, mistrial. Public reaction was swift and polarized. Some believed Carolyn had just escaped justice. Others thought the case was built on shaky evidence and sexist tropes. Either way, the state wasn't finished. Within months, prosecutors announced their intention to retry Carolyn Warmus. A second trial was scheduled for early 1992. This time, they would close every gap, tighten every angle, and remove every doubt. Carolyn, meanwhile, remained free on bail. She walked through the media firestorm like someone clinging to a story she couldn't let go. Her face was on every news broadcast. Her name became shorthand for a kind of fatal femininity. Dangerous, manipulative, calculating. The glove was still the centerpiece. It would remain the most contested piece of evidence in the entire case. In her mind, she was innocent. But in the court of public opinion, she had already been convicted. Chapter 4. Two Trials, One Obsession. By the time Carolyn Warmus returned to court in early 1992, the story had already taken on a life of its own. The media called her the real-life, fatal attraction, the unhinged mistress driven to kill. The tabloids printed side-by-side images of Glenn Close and Carolyn, speculating on whether the film had inspired real-life murder. But the courtroom was no place for fiction. The second trial would demand facts, clarity, and proof beyond a reasonable doubt. The prosecution came out stronger, tighter, and more focused. They knew what hadn't worked the first time. They knew that the glove, while compelling, couldn't be their only anchor. This time, they leaned harder on the details. The sequence of events, the forensic timeline, and the psychological profile of a woman who couldn't let go. They began by reconstructing the final day of Betty Jean Solomon's life, using phone records, witness testimony, and circumstantial data. They recreated the evening of January 15th, 1989, minute by minute. According to prosecutors, Carolyn had obtained a stolen driver's license to buy the .25-caliber Beretta pistol. She had learned to shoot, practiced in secret, and made multiple attempts to track Paul's whereabouts in the days leading up to the murder. On the night of the crime, they argued, she had slipped into Betty John's home, possibly using a key or simply knocking on the door. She then allegedly shot Betty John 9 times, 6 times in the back, 3 in the legs, and pistol-whipped her, leaving her to bleed out in the basement. Afterward, she disposed of the weapon, but kept the tan cashmere glove, which she eventually gave to Paul Solomon, trusting him to protect her. That glove remained the crown jewel of the prosecution's case. This time, they brought in more forensic experts. A crime lab technician testified that the bloodstains on the glove were consistent with the victim's blood type. A fiber analyst linked the glove's material to strands found at the crime scene. A ballistics expert confirmed that the weapon used could easily have been a .25 caliber Beretta, consistent with Carolyn's purchase weeks earlier. But the prosecution didn't stop at forensics. They called to the stand friends, co-workers, and even Paul's teenage daughter. Several witnesses testified to Carolyn's erratic behavior, including harassing phone calls, surprise visits, and desperate letters. One co-worker said Carolyn had once shown up at school looking distraught, asking about Paul's location, saying, "If I can't have him, no one will." The implication was clear. Carolyn's obsession had turned dangerous. But the defense wasn't without ammunition. They argued that Paul Solomon had motive, access, and, most notably, possession of the glove. Why had he hidden it? Why had he waited months to disclose its existence? They painted him as manipulative, even deceitful. A man juggling multiple women, one of whom had ended up dead. They also attacked the prosecution's timeline. If Carolyn had committed the murder, they argued, how had she returned to her home without anyone seeing her? Why was there no physical evidence? No gunpowder residue, no bloodstains on her clothes, no eyewitnesses placing her near the scene? The defense called expert witnesses to cast doubt on the glove's significance. One questioned whether the bloodstains were even visible to the naked eye. Another claimed that the fiber evidence was too generic to prove direct contact. They suggested the glove had been planted, or at the very least, used as a scapegoat. And then came Carolyn's decision. She would not testify. It was a gamble. In high-profile cases like this, a defendant's silence can work against them. Jurors want to hear from the accused. They want emotion, remorse, or denial. But Carolyn stayed silent, and her legal team held the line, arguing that the evidence against her, while emotionally compelling, didn't meet the burden of proof. For nearly 6 weeks, the trial played out under a national spotlight. Reporters lined the courthouse steps. TV vans surrounded the building. Every day, the courtroom was packed, journalists, curious onlookers, and friends of the Solomon family. The trial wasn't just about guilt or innocence anymore. It had become a spectacle, a cultural moment. Finally, after hours of closing arguments and nearly a week of jury deliberation, the verdict came down. Guilty of second-degree murder, guilty of criminal